Recovery, the other side of the opioid epidemic. Mainers in long-term recovery share their stories. We hear a lot of bad news about the opioid epidemic, that last year in Maine, 418 people died from an opioid overdose, and that more than 63,000 died nationwide. This session, the legislature debated the use of Narcan to revive people who are overdosing. Governor LePage has insisted that Narcan does not save lives, but rather extends them. So if you follow the news, you might get the impression that no one beats an addiction to heroin or other opioids, that no one is able to live a meaningful life after addiction. That would be wrong. People do. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're going to meet a few Mainers who have done it, gotten clean, their stories, and how they succeeded, next on Maine Calling. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The news is filled with bleak headlines about opioid addiction, including a record number of deaths from overdoses in Maine last year. But what about the other side of the story? Those people who have succeeded in getting clean and are in a place now where they can share their experiences and give advice to others. That is what we are focusing on today on Maine Calling. Joining me in our studio, Natasha Huff. She is in long-term recovery for heroin addiction. She's been clean since 2013 and is currently pregnant with her third child. She works as a caregiver. Sam Mercer is the manager of Nickelodeon Cinemas in Portland. He is also in long-term recovery. And Seth Blaze was addicted to heroin for many years. He now writes and speaks about his experience, including as a columnist for the Portland Press Herald. Seth also serves on the board of directors for Crossroads and is active in lobbying for policies to combat the opioid crisis in Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you or someone you know struggling with an addiction? Do you have questions for our guests? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I'm going to start by asking all three of you if you can tell us your story a little bit. And Seth, since you write about it, I'm going to put you on the spot first.
Sure. So my story, you know, as you mentioned, I was addicted to drugs and later on specifically IV heroin use for several years. And for me, it started when I was, let's say, about 19, 20 years old. And it started with prescription medication, prescription opiates, which I think is a fairly common.
Did you have
theme.
An injury?
Yeah, I had injuries. Yes, and I did have prescription opiates for injuries, but I don't know that that necessarily started it. I did, you know, at some point recreationally use prescription medication, and completely honestly, at the time, not really understanding even what it was, what the effects would have on me using it recreationally. It was something. You know, I think as a young person, especially at that time, before we've had so much awareness around it today, you don't really understand that it's so similar, the compound is so similar to heroin, or you don't really equate the two, and you think that maybe it's safer because it's a medication that my doctor prescribed me or prescribed to a friend, not realizing the road that you're potentially setting yourself up to head down.
Wow. And how long did you use, and what made you really, I mean, I know everybody who uses, or I've read that everybody wants to quit, but was there a turning point for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and like you just said, I've never met anyone who's suffering from addiction that doesn't want to get better. It's just when you're in that situation and in that mental state, it's very difficult to see your way out of it. And the question you asked me is a great question. And it's the question that everybody has, which is, what was that defining moment, or was there some sort of silver bullet or something that caused you to be able to enter recovery? And my answer is usually that I think I had several of those moments. The difference is being able to take those moments and turn the wanting to get sober and wanting to enter recovery into action. And took me a long time and a lot of different attempts and a lot of those big moments to figure out exactly how to do that. And it wasn't linear. It wasn't easy. It wasn't simple. It was, you know, very, you know, kind of all over the place and several different methods and, you know, several relapses until I eventually could find any extended and long-term recovery.
And how long have you been clean?
So I entered into recovery in November of 2016, which I thankfully, through the intervention of some people close to me, was able to get into a sober living situation, a safe housing situation in Portland. And that really helped give me the accountability to, you know, not only dry out physically from the substances that I was using every day for so many years, but get connected into a community that was full of other young people in the city that are in recovery and people that I could learn from and do some self-reflection and really go down the road to healing myself.
Great. And before I move on to the others, the whole time that you were using, you also were holding down a job and living what most people would call a regular life, right?
Yeah, I worked really hard to maintain this outward look of being successful and having a great life. And I think outwardly on social media and to people that weren't in my immediate circle, I think it looked as though I had maybe the perfect life with everything that you could ever want. And the reality was that it really wasn't the case. And I was miserable. I was struggling. I was sick. You know, obviously the financial and business trouble that comes with addiction often, you know, were all things that I experienced, and a lot of personal losses and, you know, the typical things like, you know, divorce and different, you know, issues that come up that are very typical. I definitely experienced. And, it really wasn't until I was able to accept and be able to proclaim that I was somebody who struggled with addiction and somebody that was in recovery that I could really, you know, hold myself accountable and really actually honestly be in recovery.
Mm. Natasha, well, Seth was talking, you were nodding.
Yeah.
Yeah, so even though your stories in some ways are very different, there are also a lot of things you relate to. When did you start using?
I, too, was 19, and I guess I just started using because all my girlfriends had left for college, and I was at home working, and some old high school friends had come in to where I worked, and we just started hanging out, and then just started using pills, methadone wafers, they were called back in the day, and it just kind of trickled, and then started using heroin and other drugs, and yeah.
How long did you use?
Up until 2013, I was actively using, and I've been on Suboxone since 2010, but wasn't using it as prescribed. And now, since 2013, I've been taking it as prescribed and whatnot.
So like Seth, and like so many people, you tried more than once.
Oh, yeah. I was always, you know, trying to either stop my medication, stop using, you know, the dope and whatnot, and you really just couldn't, and the pull of the drugs was just stronger than me at the time.
What do you think the thing was for you in 2013?
My son and getting pregnant. That's been my biggest motivator of not wanting to lose my kids.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you want to use, you think about your kids.
Oh my gosh, totally. Because even now, 4 years out, every day is a struggle for me, and that's why I am on my medication.
Do you get support other than the chemical support of the Suboxone? Do you go to any groups
where
Seth said he knows others in the city? Are you the same way?
Yes, I go to a monthly group. I've graduated. It is an every other week program, but I get to go once a month, and it's an all women's group, and it has transformed into a postpartum pregnancy group, and then you kind of go on to the other baby group or whatever. And I go to that once a month, and I guess I'll be going to speak with this is my third pregnancy and whatnot. So I'll be going to speak with women who are newly pregnant or, you know, just their first time being pregnant and on Subutex and whatnot, because, there's nothing to really be afraid of or scared of about the baby.
All right. And Sam, you've been on Main Calling before. We did a Oscars show.
Yeah, we did.
And tell us your story. Is it similar to, were you 19 when you started using? And
well, I mean, when it comes to opiates, I was, I think, late 1920s. when I started using opiates, when I actually was like, you know, alcohol or anything like that, it was 14 or 15.
Oh.
Like I started early, and went pretty hard for a long time. I got sober, like I turned 21 in rehab. So it's like, it happened pretty early for me. I didn't really have a single moment of, you know, this is the moment of clarity. It was just sort of a culmination of, like, I realized I had spent, like, the past 4 months kind of, you know, even though I was living at home, I was still sleeping in my car all the time for some reason in like, my community college parking lot instead of going to classes. You know, I had failed out of a private college, like, definitely was hearing my mom cry, like, on a nightly basis. And so it just sort of reached a point where it was like, yeah, so I'm destroying my parents and people who love me and myself. And if it was just me, I could have lived with that, you know.
You had kind of an unconventional path.
I mean, I guess so. I don't think there is a conventional path for this. That's the thing, is that there's no, like, so I'm from Ohio. I went to a dual diagnosis wilderness program because I got my folks were very generous in helping me. Dual diagnosis is substance and mental illness. And then I lived in a sober house for a year.
So you went out into the wilderness for how long?
It was 60 days.
Wow. Okay.
You know, and it was tough and weird. And you have, like, the first like 2 weeks of being sober are the strangest 2 weeks of your life. I think in a lot of ways, because you suddenly have emotions again. And I don't know if Seth, Natasha, you guys can agree with me on this one, because everybody, that's one of the things that's so weird about addiction, is that people who aren't in it try to treat it monolithically, as if it is the same for everyone. Mm. And it is something that is so incredibly different for every person who goes through it. The circumstances, how you use, what you use, what happens to you. There's certain stuff that is similar, like we have shared experiences and shared sensations, but it's not something you can treat as the same. So when I hear stuff like it was, you know, I've had an unconventional ride, I mean, there's nothing wrong with saying that, but it's no addict has had a conventional ride.
So how long ago was it that you went on that expedition?
Eight years now.
8 years.
Yeah.
And are you like Natasha? Do you every day?
Not anymore. For a while, like easily for the first, you know, 2 or 3 years. Yeah. It was pretty every day. Now it's mostly just like, wow, it sure would be nice to have a Stella Artois on this very bright, sunny day. And it's like, I can't do that because that's going to lead to a whole bunch of bad decisions.
So you don't use anything?
No.
What about you, Natasha?
I'm just on my medication. I don't drink.
Yeah. And what about you, Seth?
No alcohol or any substance that would be mind-altering.
And the folks that you know who you are in your community, the same?
I think in certain communities, it's definitely a very strong opinion that, you know, alcohol is a no-go for someone who's recovering from opiates or other illicit drugs. But with that said, you know, like Sam alluded to, is everybody's pathway is a little bit different. And I do know people very close to me that have, you know, chosen to use alcohol again, and that's their recovery, and they seem happy and healthy. And I don't necessarily agree with, you know, any hard lines in the sand as far as, you know, any substance, whether it's alcohol or, you know, marijuana or any, you know, Suboxone or methadone. Everybody has certain opinions on that and what recovery should look like. But at the end of the day, recovery is, you know, somebody's own opinion. And if somebody tells me that they're in recovery, they are in recovery regardless of when the last time they used a substance or what the recovery looks like.
Well, I want to ask all three of you, and really, this is the big reason I wanted to do this program today. What advice do you have for someone who is either sitting at home who wants to get clean or who loves someone and they're worried about their son, their daughter, their cousin, what do they need to hear?
You know, I think I can really only speak to my personal experience, and I know for me what prevented me from getting help, I think, was stigma. I was terrified of identifying as somebody that had a substance use disorder. I was terrified for, you know, professional and personal reasons as being labeled as something or being labeled as a person in recovery. And I felt shame around that. And I was scared to, you know, it's a big commitment to be held accountable and say that, you know, I'm a person in recovery and come on the radio and say that I don't do drugs and I don't drink alcohol because I'm holding myself accountable. And that's a big step to say that I'm never going to do those things again. And it's very difficult to come out and do that. But I would say if you are sitting at home and you don't know, you know, how to go about getting in recovery, I would say that people do absolutely care about you. People love you. We want you to succeed in your recovery. And, you know, me personally, you can reach out to me. I'm easy to find. I'm happy to use my resources to help anyone who's listening get connected into recovery. And just know that there is no shame in identifying as a person in recovery. And it's very courageous to come out and do so and say that. And I think that you'll find that you'll gain a lot of respect from the community and a lot of support.
What about you, Natasha? What do you want people to know?
I would like people to think that you just... Oh, I'm so nervous right now. Sorry.
You do it.
I just would want people to know that you just have to have something that is bigger than the drug and that you just care about so much more, whether it's big or small, your family or an object. Just have something that you can always turn to in your mind and just be like, you know, I love that so much more than the feeling I get from using.
And what about you, Sam?
Well, as somebody who was coming at this from a place of self-destruction, like very intentionally, it wasn't until I really realized that it's, you know, it's not about me. It's about the impact on other people that I have. It wasn't even so much of a question of like, do I want to get sober? It was a, do I want to live? And then it was a, do I want to get rid of myself more than I want to hurt other people? And I realized I didn't want to be the cause of more pain than I already was. And so it was easier for me to just stop.
That's such a good one.
Yeah, and it's if you want to get sober, the best advice I have or any addict will have is do it. Go to a meeting, go talk to somebody, don't use today. That's the only way it's going to happen. And yeah, it's going to be real hard. But it does get easier and it is ultimately a lot better. You know, there's still really hard days, but now I can recognize that it's just a hard day for a BS reason, and I can wake up tomorrow and it's not going to be a hard day. Whereas if I was using and it was a hard day, it was going to be a hard day for the next month.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
like, my gosh, believe it or not, we have to take a break already. When we come back, we'll talk to some others in long-term recovery and we'll also take your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Maine Community Foundation, celebrating 35 years of investing in Maine communities. Learn more at mainecf.org.
On the next Fresh Air, President Trump has used Twitter to insult his opponents, fire his Secretary of State, and fire up his base. But he has a director of social media, Dan Scavino, whose office is next to the president's. So what does Scavino do? We'll talk with Robert Draper about his New York Times Magazine article, "The Man Behind the President's Tweets." Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. High School Quiz Show Maine continues on Maine Public Television. The competition is heating up as students across the state really stretch their brains to win the championship. They'll take on the winners of Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island later this spring. In this week's quarterfinal match, neighboring schools Scarborough and Cape Elizabeth face off to answer questions about Maine, science, history, math, and more. You can catch the contest and perhaps quiz yourself along the way tonight at 8 on Maine Public Television. For more information about what's involved in High School Quiz Show Maine and how to register your team for next year, you can head to mainepublic.org and click on television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, our guest, sharing stories of recovery from opioid addiction. Joining me today, Sam Mercer, the manager of the Nickelodeon Cinemas. He was formerly addicted to opioids. Seth Blaze, who works in marketing, he's dealt with addiction to heroin for many years and now advocates for policies to help combat the opioid crisis. And Natasha Huff is a caregiver and mother of two with a new baby on the way. She's in long-term recovery for heroin addiction. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You know, there's been a lot in the news about the wait time for recovery programs, how hard it is to get in. Sometimes when people feel like they're ready, then they can't get in. Seth, what would you say to someone who's in that position? Is there a way to start to help yourself before you get into a formal program?
I think that's a great question. You know, I'm not going to sugarcoat the fact that there's definitely statewide, when it comes to policy and available resources, there's a lack of understanding of what is available as well. You know, the public, I think, doesn't fully understand how difficult it can be to get treatment in the state of Maine, especially for our most vulnerable populations that, you know, are maybe homeless or uninsured or have a criminal record. It's extremely difficult. I'm just going to give you one quick example. I was lucky enough when I lived in the sober house to volunteer at the Preble Street homeless shelter in downtown Portland. Now, if you've never been in there, there are two bathrooms, and in the bathrooms are motion detectors with lights on the outside. The reason for those are so that if and when somebody overdoses in a bathroom and they stop moving, the staff can unlock the door and save that person's life. Now, every single person that's been revived with naloxone at Preble Street has sought treatment and wanted treatment, but none was available. Now, if that doesn't paint a picture for you of the dire situation of some of the people in our community, I think it's important for the public to know those things and realize that it's not as easy as saying, I want treatment. With that said, there's always, of course, you can do something. You know, whether the action that you're taking is the right action or the best action, I think taking action in general is always the best thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's far better than doing nothing. And so, like Sam said, go to a meeting, do absolutely anything, reach out. You know, if, you know, stand in line at 7 in the morning at Milestone Detox and get into a bed and go there every morning if you have to. You know, even if the state is letting you down, don't let yourself down. Don't let your family down. Do everything you can. And the most important thing is to just to do something.
Yeah. When I say, you know, the best way to get sober is to just do it is like that's true. But if you don't have the assistance or the programs available to you, I was really fortunate in that I had people who were able to get a loan to help me get to a private facility. I mean, and that's the thing is that it's like, that's rare and that's luck. I was very lucky. And if there are not public support networks available, then, and the ones that are available get vilified in the public eye just for existing, you know, we end up with this situation where we have people who know nothing about what it's like going through treatment and saying, well, you know, some guy on the radio said, just do it. And it's like, it's more complex than that.
Yeah.
You know, and it is always something where having the facilities available is a huge help. And if you are a medical professional out there, you know, one of the things you can do is if you have a patient who wants to get better, you can help them find a space. And if you are willing to go above and beyond, help them find funding, because that's a big part of it. Trying to do anything in active addiction is tough. Trying to get a loan while in active addiction,
forget it.
Yeah, like it's not going to happen. Mm. Somebody else is going to have to get that for you. And, you know, that's somebody who is trusting you to stay sober. Like, it's a thing, you know?
Yeah, that's huge. And I remember when the police departments were offering to send people out of state to go to rehabs and whatnot. I don't know if those programs are still available.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it's very sad that the programs that we do have where money is raised and we're able to send somebody to treatment, you know, I think you're specifically talking about the program in Scarborough is probably what you're referencing. Mm-hmm. They are sending people out of state. We're sending people in our own state out of state because we can't take care of them and we're not willing to take down the roadblocks so that they can explore these different pathways. You know, we're constantly putting up new obstacles and putting up barriers to treatment in our state when we need to be breaking down those barriers. And regardless of what that pathway is, whether it's medication-assisted treatment or absolutely any pathway, we need to make sure that it's open and available.
Joining us on the line now, Alan Beam. Alan lives in Portland, and he is in medication-assisted treatment for opioid addiction. Alan, thanks for calling in. And if you could briefly tell us your story, how long ago did you begin the medication-assisted treatment, and how is that working for you?
I started like 14 or 15 months ago. I was in the hospital for blood disease, and I joined her. Dr. Fellows came in and started talking to me and asked me if I'd be interested in joining the Suboxone program. And that's when I started anyway.
All right, 14 or 15 months. Congratulations. And I could ask Natasha this as well, but explain to people who don't understand what the Suboxone does that enables you to, assist you in your recovery.
At first, I think no one... Probably, you know, knowing that you can get high. I think at first that's really the feeling of it, you know, knowing that even if you do something that it's going to block it, you know, so you're not going to spend your money on it, you know.
I see. So the Suboxone blocks any impact that you might, any positive impact you might have.
Oh, no, it blocks the heroin if you're trying to use with. While you're taking it or whatever.
Okay.
But it's big for stopping cravings. And for me, it's just the daily dose of doing it. It just helps because I would be actively using.
Feeling normal, I would say.
Feeling normal. Alan, I understand you have a daughter. Was she aware of your addiction? And can she tell the difference between then and now?
Oh, I'm sure she can tell the difference. But I kind of kept it, you know. I kind of kept that away from her, you know. But when I came down with that blood disease and was hospitalized and stuff, of course, I called her from the hospital. And, you know, she was hysterical because the first thing she thought was, you know, my father's going to die. And, you know, so, you know. But I'm sure she can see a difference in me from now till then, you know. I'm quite a lot different.
Alan, before we let you go, I want to ask, do you have any advice for anyone who's listening and trying to fight an addiction?
I would say, you know, I've tried many times to get done over my life. So, you know, I've been in the drugs for like 20 years. But, all I can say is, you know, just keep trying. You'll learn something from every time, you know, and then finally you might be able to get it right.
Alan, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Yeah. Alan Beam struggled with addiction for 20 years and is now in medicated-assisted treatment. I'm going to go to David, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
First, I want to say congratulations to all three of your guests on their recovery so far. And I know it's a struggle, but
thanks, David.
My question is, I'm a prescriber of opioids. And I was wondering what, if any, recommendations they have for me to talk to a patient that I suspect has an opioid problem. It can be an awkward conversation. And, you know, the last thing I want to do is offend somebody to the point where they leave my office and, you know, go off and do something that wouldn't be so wise. So I was wondering what, if any, advice they have for me.
Well, it's always going to be an awkward conversation. That's just a fact. I think that the other part of it is that it's like, you know, if you suspect somebody might, like, I would say just my general thought on this is less prescription of opiates to begin with. If you are going to, then, like, definitely be sure that you are going over very specifically just how dangerous these things can be with everyone. And if you suspect somebody has a problem, I'd say ask them.
Yeah.
You know? And if they get mad and they don't want to come back, then
there's the answer.
Yeah, that's their prerogative. I mean, you can't stop that. Seth may have a little bit more insight than me. He's a little bit more in the community than I am, but as a non-medical professional and in general blunt person, if you suspect somebody is using, ask, and then believe them. If they say no, then they are not. If they are, then get them help.
And maybe go off their vibes in your office. Yeah. You know, if somebody's using, they probably aren't going to be acting like themselves. They might be a little awkward, you know. So.
David, first off, I just want to say thank you for calling in. And I think it says a lot where you stand and where you are. Just your willingness to be able to call in and ask this question mm-hmm. as somebody who's prescribing these medications says a lot in itself. I think it's less about, you know, whether you confront somebody or not and more about your approach to doing so and letting them know that you're not doing so in a judgmental way or a condescending way and making sure they know that you are a medical professional and a medical provider and you are bringing this up because you want to help them. And it's important, you know, one of the big things for people finding recovery is, you know, having consistent connections with other healthy human beings, mm-hmm. whether that's somebody else in recovery or another medical professional that can help them. And you have the opportunity with making a connection with these people that, you know, whether, you know, you might not be able to make a massive difference in a 5-minute conversation, but you having the opportunity to see this person on a consistent basis and have a positive impact, whether it's one inch at a time to move them towards a better life and a better recovery or some sort of harm reduction, I think you're doing a great service to everybody. And I really appreciate you, you know, thinking about this and asking that question.
David, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to turn now to Andrew Kazulis. Andrew's in long-term recovery from substance use disorder and currently pursuing a master's degree at the University of Southern Maine, and he is active in a number of recovery organizations. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us on. And again, I'll echo what has been said. Thank you so much for covering this topic. Briefly, if I can talk to the doctor that just called in, Espert, yourself and your entire office trained on Espert screening, brief intervention, referral to treatment. Very effective program, highly utilizes motivational interviewing. Excellent to have people trained in the office that can be brought in to kind of talk to people and ask them questions instead of, like Seth said, being judgy or blaming or, you know, kind of, you know, approaching it in a way that might push them off.
And you said Espert, again, so S-P-E-R-T?
S-B-I-R-T, screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment.
All right. I'm jotting that down. We'll try to get that resource up on our webpage. And I just want to have you, Andrew, if you can, join the conversation here about, for you, what has been the key to staying on the path to recovery, and what kind of advice would you like to offer those who may be in a position where you were a few years ago?
That is a really great question, and I think it's also very important to focus on what got me to ask for help. I think that's often lost in a lot of conversation when we talk about substance use disorder is people say, you know, what was your bottom, quote unquote, not, you know, what got you to ask for help and to whom did you go, to whom did you, you know, feel safe enough to go to ask for help, because what keeps me in recovery? I continue to explore my ability to ask for help and to, you know, kind of engage in different parts of the community, engage in different parts of myself, and just ask myself for help and develop that faith in others, develop that faith in myself, that belief in others, that belief in myself, and that trust And so what keeps me in recovery is connecting with fellows, connecting with peers, but also daring myself to dream and then meeting myself where I dream and just kind of continuing to explore that. And that's, I think, what the recovery community does really well for, you know, the rest of the recovery community and a huge portion of the greater community, you know, that wants to see people in recovery succeed. We like to call them recovery allies, and we encourage people to identify as recovery allies and sing that beautiful song, you know, I'm a recovery ally, I'm here, I'm with you. but there's a whole portion of the community that really wants to see your dreams to reality. I never underestimate the power of the invitation and dare to ask the question, you know, and offer an invitation to citizenship.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and talking about your experience, Andrew. Andrew Kazulis is in long-term recovery. He is studying for a master's in policy planning and management at USM and is active in the recovery advocacy community in Maine. Before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. We are going to talk about the increase in vaping or e-cigarettes. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Green Lion Gallery in downtown Bath, committed to making original art available to all. Shows, classes, and events at greenlionart.com.
A computer crash at the IRS on Tuesday forced the tax collecting agency to extend the filing deadline by a day. The former commissioner says old computer systems and congressional budget cuts meant something was bound to give.
It wasn't totally surprising that there would be a glitch. The surprise was that it happened on tax day.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The IRS meltdown this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich joins us to discuss the dangers of income inequality and the vital importance of morality for our democracy. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures.
Stay with us for City Arts and Lectures. That's coming up in about 20 minutes after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Voices of Recovery. Some people have found the ability to fight opioid addiction. Joining me today, Seth Blaze in marketing for the automotive industry. After recovering from an addiction to heroin, he now writes and speaks about his experiences and lobbies for policy change. Natasha Huff is a mother and caregiver. She is in long-term recovery for heroin addiction. And Sam Mercer works as a manager of Nickelodeon, the manager of the Nickelodeon Cinemas. He used to be addicted to opioids. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Sam, before the break, we were talking with Andrew about, you know, really caring about yourself.
Yeah. And part of that is part of staying clean for me is finding out what I enjoy doing. Because there was a lot of, you know, one of the things I realized is that it's like there's a lot of culture thrown at young Americans is go out to a bar and drink. Do you want to meet people? Go to a bar and drink and you will meet somebody. And if you're going the no alcohol route, of staying sober, like that can be really hard and alienating. And so you have to sort of navigate through a lot of popular culture and media that all revolves around drug
sure.
usage and drinking. And so you have to figure out what you like, why you like it, and what else you enjoy doing. And in finding that, you discover that like there is a lot out there that you can do. Like for me, it's writing. I did performance poetry for years. I was part of a Portland team that went to the National Poetry Slam a couple times. I've been to the individual World Poetry Slam. And it's just because that's something that I enjoyed doing. And it helped, you know. Doing stuff that you like helps. And finding, it's like, well, I don't know what I like. And it's like, this is a really good opportunity to find out. And to, like, try stuff. And if you don't like it, then, okay, try some other stuff. You know?
And Natasha, you agree. You are over here nodding away.
Yeah, totally. Ever since I've, you know, stopped using, I'm, you know, care about myself more, and I didn't care about how I looked and was a mess. And now I feel good about myself again. Geez, I haven't felt this good in years.
Mm. Yeah. We have an email from Jen. Recently learned that my adult child is using, looking for resources for me to learn how to approach her. Thoughts?
Yeah, this is a tough one. I think first and foremost, you know, it's important to, you know, if you're a parent and you're in this situation and you're beating yourself up over this, you need to first realize, you know, put down the bat and realize this is not your fault. This is not a failure of your parenting, and this is not something that you should beat yourself up for. And you need to let your child know that you love them and you care about them and you are here for them if they do choose to come forward and get help. What's interesting about my story related to this is the first person that I confided in originally and told about my own addiction was my father. And the reason I was able to do that is because my father also struggled from drug and alcohol addiction and actually later passed away from his addiction. But the reason I went to him was not because I thought he was going to be a great mentor and be able to guide me in the right direction. It was because I knew that I could tell him and he would know and understand and not judge me because he was experiencing those same things. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important to know as a parent that your child needs to be able to know that they can come to you and not be shamed and not feel judged and not feel worse than they already do. Because I guarantee you they feel really bad about themselves.
Yeah, that's a big thing.
And so it's important to be supportive.
I'm going to go to Jay, who's calling from Cumberland. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. Go ahead.
I just wanted to call in and say that I think this program is really important. I am in recovery. I've been clean from heroin for 4 years now. I recently moved to Maine, though, and although I've really gotten my life on track and I'm really proud of all of the things that I've done, the stigma of being a heroin addict is something that is kind of haunting in a way a lot of times. And I just kind of want to get the perspective of your guest today of how they deal with that and how other people can deal with that. And, you know, what kind of resources and groups and other people that, you know, people like me and many others can, you know, reach out to and speak with. And
we have a Facebook post that's similar. John posts, you know, there is shame, and it might be better to remind listeners that shame can be transformed into pride in recovery. Natasha.
Yeah, I feel prideful. I don't really feel shameful anymore. I'm, you know, I own it, and I can't change the fact that I do and did struggle with, you know, substance abuse. And I think just trying to own it and, you know, it is a part of you and just accept it, I guess.
For me, it is an issue of finding people you trust and will support you. In programs, out of programs, sober, not sober people, doesn't matter. You find people who will support you and care about you. And that's tough to do. It does mean going out and meeting strangers and eventually being like, hey, by the way, I'm in recovery, so I'm, you know, we're not going to go to a bar and drink. I mean, we can go get coffee, or if we do, I'm not going to get drunk, and I hope that doesn't make you feel awkward, which is a weird conversation to have with somebody. But the reality is, if somebody is shaming you or trying to shame you or wants to mock you or anything for or believe in the stigma of being in recovery or having once been an addict, then honestly, they can go screw. There's no polite way to say it. For me, I've never been a fan of being too polite about this, because it's not a polite disease. It's not a polite experience. And if the reality for me is if somebody really buys into the stigma of addicts being once doing a bad thing, always being bad people, then, you know, I don't care. I don't care about their opinion about me because they're not here to support me. And if they want to say they are, then they need to shift that opinion, because as long as somebody has that view of an addict as being a bad person, or as that being part of your history as being shameful, they're not really being supportive.
All right.
So that's just me, and I'm a jerk. So
no, you're not. Jay, thank you for your call. Bill, go ahead. Bill's calling from Brunswick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, given the fact that, you know, prescription opiates are a root cause of a lot of the addiction and a lot of the ODs, I was wondering the perspective of your guest. How would you apportion the initial blame for that? I mean, would you put it more on the providers who are too quick to prescribe opiates, or would you put it a good chunk on, you know, patients who aren't willing to, you know, put up a bit of short-term, mostly acute pain?
Well, here's the thing. Blame doesn't really help us a whole lot right now. We're kind of in a problem. We're in a situation where the issue is needing to get the systems of recovery in place first and foremost. And when it comes to blame and medicine, it's history has proven that medical sciences will always go to some new, not fad even, but like there's always new science. There's always a new pill. There's always a new drug. There's always a new procedure that will help make everything better. And it gets prescribed a lot. And it was opiates. When x-rays were new, everything got an x-ray. You know, you had a problem with your throat, x-ray, you know, douse it with x-rays, that'll fix it. When people discovered radium, you know, they would sell radium water as a health tonic. That is the worst thing you can do for your health. It is. So when it comes to like, who's at fault, who is the blame? Is it patients? Is it doctors? That's not the important issue at hand. The important issue is getting in place treatment systems, recovery programs. And I know that that's kind of a cop-out answer, and I'm sorry, but it's one of the things that I've learned that has helped me is that blame doesn't fix this or make it easier to deal with, and just kind of stokes resentment and bitterness towards the entire subject, when really we just need to be moving to the acceptance of it has happened. It is a part of America right now, and we need to do something about it.
Bill, thanks for your call. I'm going to move on because we have so little time and so many people with questions. Sherry on Facebook says, my sister was one of the 376 people who died in 2016 from an opioid overdose. I would like to know what's being done to stop these deaths from happening. This year, 42 more people from Maine died than in 2016 from an opioid overdose. I hope part of the discussion during your program today will include some treatment options, insurance coverage, and a plea for Medicaid expansion to cover the costs for treatment of addiction and mental health. And Sherry, I'll respond to you that we have organized today's program in a different way. We did not reach out to people who are going to list the options available, but we do plan to put a lot of resources on our webpage and on our Maine Calling Facebook page. But Seth, why don't I just ask you to very briefly respond to Sherry's concerns, because I suspect you share them.
Sure. And thank you, Sherry, for, you know, having the courage to speak about this. And I'm very sorry for your loss. One of the things that I've been most recently very heavily focused on is talking about harm reduction. And we talk about things like naloxone and being able to reverse potential opioid related deaths and overdoses. And there's a lot of pushback from Governor LePage, as well as a lot of people politically and in the community. And, you know, my main point is always that we're in the midst of a crisis. Human life is valuable. And I agree that naloxone and harm reduction measures are not the key to somebody finding a recovery, but you can't enter recovery if you're dead. And we need to focus on saving lives and giving people the opportunity to recover before they die. And yes, something like naloxone, it only prolongs your life. It doesn't recover you from addiction. But that is the entire point of modern medicine, is prolonging your life so that you die at a later date. And so it's important for us to realize that and not put it in a different class because we have a stigma around addiction or we think it's a moral failing.
We'll go to Richard calling from Hollowell. Richard, go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Oh, yes. I was a heroin addict from about 16 to 24-ish or so. Started out with my MAT in methadone, the clinics, where I continued to use for the probably first 2.5 years or so. And then was luckily able to taper and transfer to Suboxone treatment. The problem that I have now is that I've pretty much got my life in order for the most part, in terms of not using or anything like that. It's been a long time. But the problem is finding Suboxone providers. I work full time. I have a family, and my work requires me to work long hours, late into the day. And so I essentially, there's only one provider I've been able to find who's been able to provide me with a time slot that will fit my schedule. They literally took like a week and a half off to look for providers that could, and met with them, that would maybe be able to meet with me, because you have to meet with them once a month.
But well, I'm glad you're able to find someone, Richard, and congratulations on your recovery. Do you all have thoughts on this?
Absolutely. I mean, I can speak to this. This just comes back to, you know, especially in Maine, but I think countrywide, where we're over-regulating and we're putting too many restrictions on pathways to recovery, and specifically with medication-assisted treatment. You know, I think it's really difficult to – why are we making it more difficult for somebody to get medication-assisted treatment and for this gentleman to get his Suboxone so that he can have a far better life and have some stability in his life now, rather than being in the chaos of an opiate addiction? And it's just it's insane that we are just putting out barriers and over-regulating instead of breaking down those walls and encouraging more people to access these types of recovery. The data shows that medication-assisted treatment works, whether you agree with it or not. It's certainly better to be on medication-assisted treatment than to be actively using heroin. And, you know, even if it's not the end-all, be-all perfect solution, we shouldn't be focused on how things should be. We need to realize how things are,
yep,
and take appropriate action to do the right thing right now.
One of the big things about medicated assistant treatment that I've always thought is there is an entire industry and market for quitting cigarettes using medicated assistance treatment. If medicated assistant treatment doesn't work, nicotine patches would not exist.
All right. Well, Sam, that's the last word. We're out of time. And Richard, thanks for your call. I apologize to anyone we didn't get to. Again, want to direct you to our website and our Facebook page, especially in a little while, some time to put together all those resources. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.